Well, hello there, film and music fans. Welcome along to Soundtrack in my weekly podcast, where I get to enthuse, along with you, about the world of film, TV and music and that beautiful relationship. So thank you very much for joining us. Really, really appreciate it. And thank you to everybody who's been getting involved on socials. We've really tried to up the game a bit and also just open up the conversation with you guys. So whether you've been leaving comments on our YouTube channel or on Instagram or whatever that may be, we really much appreciate it. And we're trying to get back to you and, you know, and kind of have a bit of an open conversation about things as much as we can. Also, thanks to everybody who responded to my request on my Instagram about Civil War and Back to Black. It was really great just to get people's thoughts on the films, which both opened on Friday. So let's get on to this week's episode. And a couple of weeks after we brought you Dev Patel and Jordan Peele talking Monkey Man, I am delighted to say we've got another Soundtracking Everyman Film Club episode for you. Today, it's the turn of director Sam Taylor-Johnson, music producer Giles Martin, and music supervisor Ian Cook to discuss Sam's Amy Winehouse biopic, Back to Black, starring Marissa Abella, who is phenomenal in the lead role. We arrive in Amy's life as a young woman with a huge talent working out how to make it on her terms. The film follows Amy through her break into the music industry, Grammy wins, with more personal stories of her troubled relationship with Blake Fielder Civil, along with her deep love for her family. Through all this, her battle with alcoholism, and also all under the watchful, sometimes abusive eye of the press. Now, the thing that I'd like to say about this film, if you haven't seen it already, is that I think that Sam has done a fantastic job and a necessary job in telling Amy's story told through her eyes, you know, her choices, her decisions, her relationships. And from reading some of the not very positive reviews of this film, I really feel like a lot of people kind of missed that whole point. But anyway, go see it and make up your mind for yourself. Sam, Giles and Ian joined me on stage in front of a wonderful audience at the Screen on the Green in Islington, North London. And where else could we begin than with the title track?
He left no time to regret. Kept his dick wet with his shame.
Congratulations. I was absolutely watching it again as well, even more so, really moved by this film because I feel like you told her story through her eyes. It's kind of her point of view and her kind of, you know, her journey really through her story.
Is this on? Yeah, it is on. Sorry. La la la. it's a bit of a late night last night, so bear with me because I'm finding it quite hard to articulate myself today. Firstly, thanks everyone for coming and also staying and listening to us and our stories. I set out on the path to making this film thinking, you know, how do I do this and how do I approach this movie to make it worth being made and for people to go on the journey? And I felt like during her lifetime, her life was so sort of picked apart and you know, and dissected, and then post her death similarly, and everyone sort of on the outside looking in. And what kind of felt like was happening was that the tragedy of what had happened to her in her life and her death was sort of creating a sense of her being a victim, and everything was overshadowing the brilliance of her and her music. And so I wanted to make this film to celebrate her again and to uphold her and almost give her her agency back, because I felt like it had been lost. And I felt the best way to do that was just to go to the lyrics with Matt Greenhouch, who wrote the movie, who also wrote Nowhere Boy, my first movie. And so we just took everything that we could that she'd written and just used that as our narrative through line and our kind of North Star, because I felt like if I was in her words and her lyrics, I felt like that was the right way to sort of just create something where we just go back to the music.
Well, it's real, almost like diary entries in a way, isn't it? In terms of real kind of her, her inner deepest thoughts. And, you know, there's that line in the film where she says, I need to live. I need to live to be able to kind of write. And that's so true. And I think it's the most personal way of telling her story.
Yeah. And she was so honest and unafraid and, you know, authentic. And I think that's why we all connect to her on so many levels, because everything, you know, she did everything so passionately and deeply. And so, you know, she loved to such a powerful extent, and she felt pain to such a powerful extent, and everything is there in everything she's written. And just to sort of go through those words and sort of feel what she was feeling in those moments just dictated quite a clear path.
Yeah. When it came to, you know, music, you talk about her music and obviously how to feature that in the film, but there are lots of different kind of music kind of moments in the film, whether it be the score, whether it be the needle drops, and whether it be her music. Navigating that journey on how you would feature her music, was that a journey, or did you know straight away that when you found your Amy, it was going to be through her performance?
It's so multi-layered. It felt like the songs that appear in the movie just felt, it just became quite clear, I guess. But I mean, to go to what you're asking, I think about Marisa and performance.
Yeah, which is from that first one in the bedroom where she's got the guitar.
Yeah.
And we feel that kind of, you're in, or yeah. I was in, and you're kind of like, okay, great. And you kind of, you know, and she's not trying to mimic. She's trying to, for me anyway, she's trying to kind of pay homage in a way, you know, she's got an essence, she's got, but it's her version. And that's really important, I think.
It was really important because when I say we, Nina Gold, who's a brilliant casting director, and I met, you know, lots of people, and we met so many amazing Amy Winehouse impersonators who were brilliant, and you know, just be like, that's incredible. But what Marisa did was very different to impersonation. She inhabited the role, she became. And it was just very much from the inside, and that's such gold dust to find. You really, you know, when you find somebody who can do that, who can really just draw within. And when I met her, that wasn't obvious at all. I met this very sweet, quite shy girl. And I do remember, if I'm honest, thinking, how's she going to pull that grit? Where's it going to come from? Anyway, Marisa came in for the reading, as did lots of other girls. Yeah. And she was the only one who came as herself. She had no cat eye or
beehive
or anything. She just came as Marisa, and she sat in front of me, and we chatted, and, you know, very sweet. And I put the camera on, and she said, just if I could just have a minute. And I said, of course. I chatted with Nina. I turned around. I put my eye to the lens of the camera, and I looked through, and Marisa looked up and looked so hard down the barrel of the camera, if you like. And I just thought, fuck, it's her. And I just grabbed Nina Gold behind me, and both of us felt it in that moment before she'd even said anything. And it was a transition within her, just a transition in her eyes that I could see she'd shifted. And I thought, if she can do that in this moment, then the work that we can do together to carry this big presence and to be able to honor her correctly, it's gonna work. And then sorry if I keep talking, I'll shut up.
Oh no, please don't, it's amazing.
I'll just ignore these two.
get to you in a minute, this is more important.
Then, you know, and then just to sort of talk about the genesis of her, because she sings the entire movie, that's her voice. She said she couldn't sing. And I said, okay, that's fine, because, you know, we have the rights to the music. We had them from Universal and Sony, and we had all of that. And so I thought, you know, that's okay. I don't expect someone to be a brilliant actress and be able to sing like Amy Winehouse. That seems like quite a tall order. But Marisa went off to train to sing, to engage her jaw, her mouth, her tongue, and the movement of her face to match Amy's. And I mean, Giles can speak to this more probably, but the more she started to do that, the more her voice and vocal cords started to shift. And she just put in a hell of a lot of training. And Giles and I, she invited us to come and sort of just see her perform. We were 2 months in and we were 2 months away from filming. So the entire process of her learning was 4 months. But 2 months in, she said, come to watch. She couldn't play guitar either, right?
No.
And she picked up the guitar and she sat on the floor and she started to sing What Is It About Men? And I was filming it on my phone and I filmed it in real time, you know, just filming it. And I thought, if I did this as a one-shot long take at the beginning of the movie and she can hold everyone's attention, then we're in for the journey of belief that this girl is Amy Winehouse. And yeah, she sang the whole movie.
Actually, it was that time in the studios where we worked out what the format of her working out the song was. That was that, you know, because we knew she wasn't going to sing the song straight away.
Yeah.
She was going to work it out. It was that. And that we did on that day was what ended up in the film.
Talk to me a little bit about kind of working together in this collaboration in terms of, you know, you have this now 2 months away from filming. You kind of see that this is possible. What then is that journey towards how you, because there are so many different types of performances in, you know, in the film. You have that kind of in the bedroom with the guitar, you have the Glastonbury moment, you have the, you know, you have Ronnie Scott's, you have Dublin Castle, you have all these different performances, even the Lauryn Hill walking down the street with the earbuds and stuff like that, you know, in terms of navigating that and working together and collaborating, how that would be. And then also Ian with you with so many questions, sorry, in terms of the needle drops. I'll come to you about all the kind of existing music in a second, but first, in terms of producing and working out the arrangements and how those performances and music would work.
I'll start with the first bit that I'd love to just continue on the thread of what we were just saying. What became apparent was Marisa being able to sing emotionally, you know, love is a losing game at that point in her life, for example, is a different resonance than a recording of Amy's, or, you know, if she can sort of laugh within singing Stronger Than Me. It just made sense that she could emotionally tell the story, even if that she's not accurately sounding exact. You go on the ride of the emotion, and that takes you to a special place. But Giles can talk more about that.
To us, the collaboration, there has to be a collaboration. I mean, Sam's the boss, and she'll say, you know, it'd be great if we could do this scene. And then I would see Marisa on a regular basis, and we get together and just go through, you know, and it's funny. It's not about stars in their eyes tonight, Matthew, I'm going to be. It's actually about a lot of the language of singing is about phrasing and the way people's words sit. A little backload their singing, you know, you watch it and they try and over-sing. And great singers like Amy didn't, you know, she doesn't over-sing. And it's bringing people back. And the funny thing about with actors, and it was saying, you know, I had the producer working with Taron doing Rocket Man, we're doing the Elton. And it's that thing where you go, okay, there's a reason why these people are great singers. But what you can do is in the same way she's portraying Amy in the film as an actress, she's portraying when she's singing. So therefore, Sam can say, this is how we're doing this. And then there's flexibility. Marisa's singing live on set. There's a flexibility where we can collaborate and direct her so she gets what it was. And there's a technical aspect to that as well as just a... But she was so... There were times... especially at the beginning of the working process, because she had to, you know, not eat. Let's be honest, it was a pretty brutal. I mean, there was a stage where she was, you know, she had to be thin, Amy. And but she was working so hard. There were days I'd just say, listen, just, you know, just, because she was just committed, and that's the thing. And then it makes you feel as though, oh, I'll do everything to make sure that you're, you know, that it was
safe. Goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what it was, live bands as well, you know, in those kind of moments where we're seeing, you know, her perform with a band, you know, yes, with the Grammy win and all that.
Well, we talked to Ian and we found her original band. It was funny that day in Abbey Road. So they came in. The original band came in on the same day that we auditioned the band that's in the film, because they're playing. And it was like something from Doctor Who. There's like yourself 20 years old, me 20, from 20 years before. And then we recorded it, and her band were amazing, you know, and we used the band that's at Glastonbury playing, not seen in the film, but actually playing, because, you know, Marisa's singing live, but you're pre-recording it.
Yeah.
Of the band that played at Glastonbury, the same musicians. And then we had these amazing, like, you know, Dale, these musicians saying, she wouldn't have done this. And that was useful for us.
You know? Yeah, it was amazing having Amy's band sort of come back together and record. But it was quite... What was truly incredible was the band came back together to record, and Marisa stepped in the studio to record with them and to stand there in front of a microphone and sing as Amy in front of Amy's band. I just kept thinking, God, she's got balls.
Yeah. What did the band think? What was their reaction to that? It must have been hugely emotional for them.
It was the times that we had the band around whilst Marisa was singing was deeply moving and emotional.
Yeah,
it was tough.
And they came down to the set as well.
They came to set on Glastonbury.
Yeah.
And
at Shepherd's Bush Empire.
And Shepherd's Bush Empire, and they, I can, you know, say, and I'm sure they wouldn't mind me saying, but they were just sat, you know, tears streaming, because obviously it brought back the memories that they never thought they needed to be back in again, in such a sort of profoundly strange, I imagine, way.
And we're making a film, but we're trying to be as authentic as we possibly can. And if you have the people that are there and experience it, and they're going, this is, and you go, doesn't, you know, then that's good.
Was that actually Glastonbury then?
Do you know, I'm so proud. I'm so happy you asked me. I'm so proud of Glastonbury as you see it, because that was shot in a room about this big.
No way.
Yep.
Well done.
Thank you.
Yeah, not just on that, but on everything. Wow, that's amazing.
I was going to say, one of the first things that I did when I came on board was actually put together a performance Bible of all the songs. And Sam specifically wanted to show her career trajectory. So it's a very sort of deliberate device where we initially see her just Amy solo, just maybe with guitar, and then with a three-piece. And then she adds a horn section. And then by the time you get to the Grammys and Shepherd's Bush Empire and Glastonbury, she's got backing vocals, and it's a really big production. But that was definitely part of the journey. So, you know, we forensically dug into the lineups, what they were wearing, what she was drinking, the instruments she was playing, like the attention to detail. We really wanted to sort of honour, like Giles said, the authenticity and the integrity of her career.
And that also goes into the artists that feature that are existing music, you know, whether it is that kind of Lauryn Hill moment as well, or Billie Holiday, and all those artists that were incredibly influential and important to her that feature within the film. Talk to me a little bit about those choices, and also kind of getting clearance for that kind of thing as well, which can be A, expensive, and too tricky.
Definitely. I mean, you know, obviously to work on this project was an absolute dream project. Amy is an incredible artist, and we had all her rich tapestry of works to work with. But I think alongside that, it was very, very important for us to show the influence and the musical heritage that she came from. And she had, you know, some very important influences in her life. Her family, her nan Cynthia was a big influence musically on her, as was her father Mitch. But alongside that, all these iconic artists: Tony Bennett, Dinah Washington, Sarah Vaughan, as you say, more contemporary ones such as Lauryn Hill, Donny Hathaway. You know, I think every choice was incredibly carefully curated, and we all just felt this real responsibility to sort of build this world around the Amy songs that reflected her influences as well.
But they're really important to you as part of the storytelling, Sam.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like Ian was saying, to sort of acknowledge all, I mean, it's quite unusual, I think, for a 14-year-old Camden girl to be obsessed with Tony Bennett. Love Tony Bennett. Yeah. But, you know, her influences were so clear and strong in the voice that we now know, once you look and hear those voices. And now, you know, I feel like they've sort of transcended time and crossed generations in the same way that Amy is now. Mm. You know, that power of her voice and how her music and her words really sort of tap into all of us on so many different levels. But it was important. But, you know, I love, I mean, Ian's great to work with, and it was so fun to listen to all this music. You know, so for every one choice you see, we probably listen to about 20, 30 to choose that one. I mean, one of my favourites that gives me so much joy is the Minnie Riperton one, when they come back and kiss, just because it's so operatic. Being able to go through that catalogue of music, and of course I was going this one, and it would be like, of course you picked that one, it's the most expensive song. So it was fun, and sort of like, can we
honestly, I mean, it was so collaborative, and I have to say that one of the things that's quite unusual in this is that once Sam decided on a choice, they stayed. I mean, we were in the edit for probably the best part of a year. It was certainly from, you know, March to the end of last year. And I don't think anything actually changed. Once it was in, that was it. And it's quite unusual, because quite often what will happen is sort of 5-6 months down the line, there's a bit of an Emperor's New Clothes aspect to it, where you've heard it and you go, oh, what else is there? But Sam was just incredibly decisive and instinctive, and just was like, that's it. And it was, you know, it's brilliant for us.
And the additional part to that whole musical puzzle is the score, with Nick Cave and Warren Ellison, that incredible song that we heard at the end there, Song for Amy. You know, you've worked with amazing composers throughout your career. I mean, Trenton Atticus Ross, and then Alison Goldfrapp as well in the past. Talk to me a little bit about Nick and Warren, why they were right for this, and what those conversations were about how and what you needed from them to complement this other part of the music of the film.
You know, score is obviously such an incredibly important aspect to the movie. And they got to a point, because people want to see what you've created, if it's the studio or writers who want to come see the movie sort of a little bit early. And I realised it was so important not to show anyone the movie until the score was in. And the reason being is because whatever music is written just shifts incredibly the dynamic of what you're seeing. And Nick and Warren's scores, I've loved since, I think, probably Assassination of Jesse James was the first time I heard their score. And they just felt so right. And when I approached Nick and he said, you know, can you show me a rough cut of the film? He just connected with it immediately in the exact right way, which was he understood. He understood what this story was. And going to work with them was like, hey, I'm off to work with Nick Cave and Warren Ellis today. And it's just the three of us in a studio with a sound engineer. It's literally like a sort of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory golden ticket moment. And I'd go to sit with them. And what's so extraordinary, or what I learned from it, was they've known each other a very long time. You know, they sort of converse via dolphin clicks. You know, they're very connected. And they don't look like they're doing very much. And then, you know, Warren will get up and he'll sort of disappear for a bit, and you don't really know where he's gone. And then he's recorded a bit of violin and it comes back in, and it feeds through, and Nick sort of leans over and does a few things on the piano. And then suddenly this magic appears, and it's such alchemy.
Thank you.
just continued like that for a couple of weeks, and until we had the score, and I literally felt like, well, I didn't see you do that. It was so sort of, it was so effortless, and the stream of consciousness that they understood and connected with this movie. It just felt like it was a very pure through line. And then on the very last day, we were just listening to everything. And the first piece of music that's up at the beginning of the movie was playing, and you know, we were watching the screen, and Nick was sort of sat quite close here, and I could hear him humming. And I saw that Warren had clocked that Nick was humming, and I could sort of sense that it was like, just ignore him, let it continue. So I kind of got into the vibe of let it just percolate, and slowly a word or two came out, and I thought, oh, he's writing a song. And then Nick sort of got up, paced around, sat back down, said a few other words, and Warren said, why don't you record what you're saying? And Nick's like, what am I saying? Am I saying? No, it's okay. Record it. and then he went further, and the words got stronger and stronger. And I said, please record it. Please record what you're saying. And he got up and he went into the room. There was a piano there, and he just freeformed that song. And it just literally, for want of a less out there way of saying it, just kind of came through. And that is, it was recorded then and there in that moment, and that's what you hear. It was quite something to witness.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Say it's time for us to call it a day. Well, I will love you anyway.
It's just the most perfect song to finish the journey of watching the film, I feel. And there are some incredibly powerful moments that their cues really resonate in the film, in the pool hall, you know, when they split up, and then also in with the media and the way that it's used over that kind of those attacks from the kind of, it makes that the feeling of watching her go through that even more terrifying and intense. Just interested in terms of, you know, was there much conversation about, or did they just react in terms of, you know, when they were writing?
I think it was really instinctual. They reacted to what they were seeing and played it out in that intense way. And it was really important to make that feel aggressive, because when I was making the film, I could Google any day of her life within a certain period and find pictures from so many different angles. And, you know, you start to sort of see all these images, you know, just these photographs. And if you sort of flip it round and see that she always had 5, 10, 12 burly men with cameras with her all the time, day and night, through the trajectory of her life, just documenting the ups and then the downs.
The downs, yeah.
And what that must have felt like. And I think, you know, just investigating what that must have felt like, because from the outside, you know, we're, oh, well, you know, with that comes that.
Yeah.
But to look at it from a young woman, you know, age 25, just, you know, it's struggling, having no chance of anonymity to deal with addiction, and just having people always following her must have been hell.
Yeah. It's that line that her... the conversation she has with her dad in Ronnie Scott's, where she says about, I'm an addict, and he says, I've never heard you use that word before. And she just says, what is it? Oh, it's because everybody else says it for me, sort of thing as well. That's like, wow. And it is that thing. And I think that that is one of the most powerful, the many brilliant things, but most powerful thing about the film is that we are kind of almost in a way reminded of what she went through, not what we went through the press's eyes of what she went through, but what she was kind of going through as well in terms of, you know, the kind of depth of that. And I love that we have those kind of, you know, those moments of optimism, those moments of hope, those moments of love, those moments of joy, you know, where she skips into her flat and puts on the jukebox and throws her book down the stair and that kind of thing as well. I love the jukebox.
That's hers. That's actually her jukebox.
Is it?
Yeah. That's her handwriting, her jukebox and her choices.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was there a lot of that for you? Was that important for you to kind of, for that, to have her stuff in the film, to have as much of her really in there as possible?
Yeah, I mean, quite often the costumes that you see were actually Amy's costumes that people loaned us back, and Marisa would put on her jewellery, and obviously that just felt so such sacred in a way. But also from Marisa, I think's point of view and perspective in... as sort of feeling that character, the minute she sort of put it on, it felt like a sort of talisman in a way.
Must have been hard for her to...
Someone did offer up one of her beehives, but I know it's all right. That felt like a step too far for Marisa to sort of wear in a sort of heavy crown sort of way.
I didn't realise that was kind of... That's incredible. It must have been hard for her to kind of walk away from then, in a way, in terms of, was there an element for all of you of kind of, you know, there's that build up and that prep to start this film, but almost the kind of the warm down almost in a way, you know, the unwind of it as well, I imagine. I mean, you're still in it because we're here talking about it, but but for Marisa to, you know, the amount of work that went into Marisa, that, both physically as well.
Yeah, Marisa went, we finished and the last day we filmed was the last day that you saw. And so on that last day, it was super intense. I mean, because we'd lived together in that life and we'd lived with Amy for that time. And it was hard to say goodbye, but Marisa said, bye, I'm off to industry, and started industry a week later. And
pro, what a pro.
And she was, and because, you know, and she'll say this, she's like, I'm not a method actor, even though it seems like, but she just has an incredible skill set. So she was just like, bye, I'm off industry.
The funny thing, we went down on the train to Cardiff to go, and she was doing industry in Cardiff, and she had to become Amy again for us occasionally. And it's like, you know,
in her lunch break.
In her lunch break. Yeah, it was... It's strange. It's strange you did the last day. That last day was kind of an unhappy day. In
it was
unhappy.
Really,
it was
hard.
It was the hardest day.
It was really hard. We couldn't hold it together, actually.
Yeah, but then, I mean, the stuff, she came back to the studios and we patched up and did bits and pieces. And it was just strange when, are we done here? It's that sort of thing. Like, it's not the same time next week anymore.
Yeah. It was hard to let go because it's, I mean, I'm still letting go, but it's because it was so, I mean, it's been nearly 3 years of my life. So it's been very immersive for that amount of time. And I think I'm struggling more than anyone else.
Don't show it at all. We've got some time. Sam's very kindly agreed to answer some audio questions. If anybody has any questions in the room, we've got a microphone. So if you want to put your hand up before... There's a lady right there. She literally bounced out of her seat. I'm going to go with you there. And then we've got one over here. Hello.
Hi. I just want to say thank you, Sam, for using the word alchemy, because it's a beautiful way to describe Amy, I think, in general. You mentioned that one of the songs is quite expensive to use in the film. I wondered if there was a piece of music or song that Amy did that you wanted to use and that you couldn't in the end for whatever reason.
I mean, we were lucky. We were given all the music rights at the beginning because it was really clear to me, to make this movie, I had to have complete creative freedom. I couldn't have any sort of hold over me, like, we won't let you use this song if you do it this way or that way. So we had all the songs, right, Ian?
Yeah, there was nothing that we wanted to use that we couldn't, certainly. That was the first thing that I did when I came on board was to negotiate the rights to all the Amy catalogue, which not just obviously Amy Winehouse, but with the notable co-writers, Mark Ronson, Salaam Remy and other people, so that we just had the rights unencumbered to move forward and realise Sam's vision, yeah.
Well, that must be kind of really kind of a great support to you in the fact that, you know, those individuals that you mentioned, you know, both in terms of the owners of it, but people like Mark Ronson and stuff, there's a trust there in terms of how and what you're going to tell in the story.
Mark Ronson, I had sent him the script early on and said, you know, I know it's probably quite difficult for you to read this, but I would love to have a sense of whether, you know, it's the right path. And he said, I probably won't read it. It's going to be way too hard. And then I said, I'll send it anyway. 2 weeks later, he wrote back and said, you have her voice. Good luck. And it was a very short message. And that was enough for me to know it was good to go forward. After our last day, we went to New York to shoot the New York stuff. And I sent him a message saying, we've just finished filming. Don't know if you're in town, but it would be great to introduce you to Marisa. And he said, why don't you come over to the studio where we recorded Back to Black? And I was like, okay, we're on our way. We'll be there in 10 minutes.
Oh my God.
And we went, and he said, look, not much has changed. This is where, you know, we started the, and started, he started playing the opening of Back to Black. And he said, and then she would sit over there and I'd play. And he got really animated, reliving and telling us the story. And, you know, it was incredible for Marisa and I to just sort of stand there and feel that.
That's incredible. Have we got someone over here? Did I see someone?
How did you manage to achieve Amy's character so well through the script?
Well, firstly, I love the so well part. Thank you. I think, you know, again, it really was watching everything that we could and hearing everything, you know, doing as much of a deep dive as possible on every aspect of her life, every aspect of all her recordings and interviews and pictures. So, you know, studying them. And then Marisa, you know, really studied and worked with a movement coach. So when you watch Glastonbury or the Grammys, I'm pretty sure you could put YouTube side by side and see Marisa's little finger in the exact same place at any given time. And all of this, and it's moment by moment she copied. But I don't want to say mimics, because it just felt like she just brought it to life in the exact same way. And, you know, that really sort of came from living through her, watching and yeah, studying all of that. And then, you know, the two of us sort of working on how that and what that looks like in a scene.
Because it's not one character, really. It's one person, but almost like that journey that she has along the story that we see is so many different versions of Amy, really, in terms of what she's going through emotionally and physically. So she's almost playing like multiple characters in a way, based on that state of mind that she's in.
Yeah, I mean, going back to, you know, the intention of making the movie, it was about showing her really, again, as a young girl, as a woman who loved, who felt, who wanted a family, who fell in love, who was hounded by the press, who had a wicked sense of humour, extraordinarily talented, and what it is to be human and what it is to feel pain and to share that unabashedly with the world.
Should we do one each side?
Hi there. I'd love to know, with regards to the casting process for Blake, yeah, how was it and how did you stumble across Jack O'Connell?
No stumbling. I mean, I literally, as soon as I was reading this, I thought Jack O'Connell. I already was a fan of Jack's through one of the best films was Startup. I just thought he was so epically brilliant, and his portrayal of that character was so memorable. And you know, spending time with Jack and getting to know him, I'd cast him in my head straight away. I really had. And I just thought, it's Jack O'Connell, and that's who it's going to be. And then the process of, you know, letting everybody else in, the process that you have to go through, and then pulling Jack on, and then getting to know Jack. And Jack just said, I know this bloke. I know this bloke. This bloke is so many versions of people I already know. And then Blake and Jack met, and Jack said, he said, as soon as I met him, he said, I completely understood every aspect. And he said, and as soon as I understood every aspect from, you know, the guy in front of me, but also understanding addiction and that struggle and everything that goes along with that, and then everyone's perception, and then all the judgment and the blame and everything. I just know a path in. And so he was right. I'd love to give a bigger story that it was, you know, a sort of worldwide hunt. But it was Jack from day one in my head.
And again, with that character, though, it's her, it's the Blake that she fell in love with that we need to see.
It is, because otherwise, if I had to go within her perspective, therefore she loved him and she wrote one of the best-selling albums and one of the best albums of our time. And so in order to understand her motive and her outpouring of emotion, you had to, we as an audience had to fall in love with Blake too, or at least understand why she fell in love with him. Otherwise, there's no journey and belief that you are any closer to understanding Back to Black. And Jack is fearless. He doesn't care that whether you like him or not, or whether he's playing a likable character. Jack just wants to be as authentic to that feeling that is possible.
So Shangri-La's moment is
Shangri-La's moment. It was,
you love that scene.
It was epic. It was literally one of the best filming days, because he
Sam phoned me on the day. He phoned me and went, "You've got to come and look at the Shangri-La's moment."
Pulled that out of nowhere. I had no expectation. There was no rehearsal. He said, "I'm going to put the..." I can't mimic his accent, but I wish I could. But he's like, "I'm going to put it on. Just you wait." Wow. That was it.
But also, he'd say, because I was sent... I always get sent anyone who's going to sing anything.
Yeah.
Not that Jack sings anything, but he didn't... And so he'd just come back from a boxing. He goes, "Boxing." He's like, "I think it'd be better if I didn't know the words," he said to me. I went, I'm not sure that's true. And he went, "Anyway, I'll be fine." And I was like, and you could tell that he was just like, pushing. Yeah. "I think it might be good, but if I just don't know the words to the songs," and then I just like, "So like, okay, but if you learn them."
It was just of course,
he's just brilliant. He's just a brilliant actor, you know.
So good. Right, last question.
Whoa!
Everyone has a question. Let's stay here all night.
Again, you pick. Go for it. Here we go. Sorry, folks.
Hey, so it's a question. So you mentioned you spent about 3 years with this film. So I guess the question is about prep and how long was prep on this project, and if there's something that you love to do specifically and spend time before everything goes crazy.
The prep time was, it is going to be 3 years quite very soon. So it's hard for me to think of it as 3 years, because it's gone... Some projects feel like you're pushing a rock up through treacle up a mountain. Some projects are just impossible. This one, I've literally had to put my running shoes on to keep up to the momentum of it, because it's just had such a speed, and it's like a runaway train of energy. And this one just had that energy, but the prep was really... The most important thing was nailing the script and understanding the story we had to tell. And once that was in place, which was really fast, because Matt wrote it, I think we sat down in November, we outlined over 2 weeks the movie we wanted to make. He went away and he delivered it in February, which is very fast.
Wow.
And the film you see is a first draft. No one wanted to touch it, because it was so perfectly structured that we felt like if we took out one scene, that would crumble or this wouldn't make sense. So that part was quick. And then after that, the prep was really about finding the right people to work on this film, the right costume designer, the right hair and makeup people. Giles and Ian and...
The wrong people as well.
and then going through the process of the array of brilliant clothes that she wore, which ones are we going to use? Of the array of her looks, how are we going to tell that story of the creation of the beehive? And also we had sort of a chart of her beehive, because what was so interesting, there was a 1 to a 10. We never did 10, but we went to at least an 8, I think. And it was interesting when you looked at it that the higher, the taller, the bigger the beehive, the more vulnerable and fragile in her life she was becoming, that it was like a sort of protection or a sort of feeling that she was
It's like the guitar she was told to get rid of.
Yeah.
So they could see more of her on stage. It's kind of.
So it's like a, I guess, almost like a distraction as time went on.
I was also going to add that prep with Marisa, we got her in early with a vocal coach called Anne-Marie Speed, who was fantastic and worked throughout the process. But she actually was working with her before she was officially cast. All the film was greenlit because we kind of knew it was her, but we just wanted to get that process happening early. Likewise, we got Ben Parker came on as guitar tutor, and then we brought on our wonderful music producer, Giles, and then we started to work. I mentioned earlier about the performance Bible that we had, and we knew who was playing each performance. So we started to work with Hilary Skews, who was really instrumental in helping cast the musicians, the on-camera musicians, who all played their own instrument. You know, the drummer is a drummer. And it was so important to us for the integrity of the live performances, which, you know, I personally think absolutely sing. But we worked so hard with that. I mean, the backing singers themselves in those performances, I mean, they were just incredible. And everyone just felt like they had a special duty to do the utmost and the best for this film.
It was really, do you remember that film? We basically did a gig in a rehearsal just before Christmas. We went to John Henry's and we had the band and Marisa performing for 2 days. And just playing solidly. So it was really, and she really, she was nervous. She'd never sung with a band before, you know. And I just thought it'd be really good just to get that element of what it's like to be having monitors and what it's like to be on. Because the weird thing about being on stage, you know what it's like until you do it. That's really important. So we just tried to. It was great. We did have a really good framework of authenticity around it.
But yeah, nonsense. I mean, prep was crazy also because we shot 56 locations in 45 days. So we were tearing around London at crazy speed.
Avoiding paparazzi.
I know we don't have a lot of time, but paparazzi was a problem because what would happen was we'd be shooting, for example, the scene you saw outside the chemist where they buy the pregnancy test and they come out, there's all the paparazzi and she falls down. We were filming that late one evening. And I said, because I had an instinct, because we've been followed quite a lot, there was a lot of interest. And I said to the actor paparazzi, look to your left and right, make sure you know who you're next to, just in case. Anyway, we were filming, and this guy went, oh, don't know this guy. And I looked, and I thought, that's a 2022 Nikon. And he was, from a well-known...
What a
fucker. Tabloid.
See, we're being authentic. That's the thing.
I love the fact that
you're like, clocked the lens. You're like, that is, get out.
But what was so crazy was I said, I was like, okay, cut, everyone. I said, oi, out. And we had, you know, security. And he went, I've got every right to get that fucking picture like they do. And I said, they're actors. That's not Amy Winehouse.
Oh, my God. That's an amazing story.
It was crazy. But that happens regularly. And I'd just be like, come on, I've only got a couple more hours to film this.
45 locations to shoot.
And he kept trying to come back in.
Same one?
Same guy. Every fucking day.
Oh, wow.
And he'd say, if you don't let me get this picture, I'm flying a drone over and then you'll have to stop shooting. So I'd go... take the picture and go. But then, life imitating art, vice versa, it became really difficult and stressful for Marisa because then pictures were appearing of her in the tabloids where, you know, she wasn't looking her best because we're shooting a really difficult scene. And she was getting really distressed. And so whenever she sensed there was a paparazzi, she'd start getting really... And so it was just this weird cyclical thing where...
Yeah,
this interest in this, you know, fragile young women.
Yeah, never going to go away. It's just like it's history repeating itself. Yeah. For a reason.
Story to end on.
I could talk to you for hours, and it was a real kind of treat to get to see it again tonight. And just thank you for reminding us of the power of her talent, really. And I've gone back and listened to Frank a lot as well, because I kind of feel like, you know, in terms of the journey of her and being reminded of the stories and how a great storyteller she was, you know, as well as a musician. So huge congratulations on this wonderful film. And thank you so much to everybody for being here. Huge round of applause, please, for Ian, Giles and Sam. Thank you.
Thanks, Edith.
Thanks so much. Safe journey home, everybody. Thank you so much for coming once again. Thank you.
You should be stronger than me. You've been here 7 years longer than me. Don't you know you're supposed to be the man? Now pale in comparison to who you think I am. You always want to talk it through. I don't care. I always have to comfort you when I'm there. Be stronger than me.
From the album Frank, that's Stronger Than Me by Amy Winehouse. Rounding off this latest soundtrack in Everyman Film Club with Sam Taylor-Johnson, Giles Martin and Ian Cook. My huge thanks to all three for joining me at the screen on the green and all those behind the scenes who helped organise that. To all who came as well, we really appreciate you showing up and just being so enthusiastic about the film and the In Conversation. Our next live show is going to be on the 25th of April at Everyman Borough Yards, and we're going to be joined by the wonderful Rose Glass, who's joined us in the past to talk about her film Saint Maud. Her new film is called Love Lies Bleeding. It stars Christian Stewart and it is absolutely out there and brilliant. We're very excited to show a preview of the film and have Rose join us for an In Conversation following that. So come and join us on the 25th of April at Everyman Borough Yards. Details can be found on our socials. We are at Soundtracking UK. Back to Black then is on general release now. If you haven't seen it already, get along and enjoy Sam's incredible work. If you want to hear my previous chat with Sam and husband Aaron, and maybe you want to listen back to Rose ahead of joining us at our Everyman Film Club, head to edithbowman.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We've also had Giles on a couple of times before. He's always great value. We'll be back next week with another conversation into the world of film, music and television. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then. In the meantime, why not follow us?